Hi there, I'm Catalina Villegas. I'm the host of Rolly's Experts Explain Everything podcast. Rolly is the platform where journalists find experts for their stories. As a journalist myself, I love to find fascinating people on Rolly, experts with deep knowledge and insight that can answer all of the questions I've ever had about their field. So today we're chatting with Alana Breitman. She has over 30 years of experience in government, the technology sector, and nonprofits. She is a senior advisor at the Roosevelt Group, a bipartisan advocacy consulting, business development, and strategic communications firm specialized in the defense, security, and intelligence sector. They're based out of Washington, D.C. And Alana is also a seasoned senior Capitol Hill and Department of Defense leader and recent senior vice president of public affairs at the Jewish Federations of North America. Alana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catalina. Very, very nice to be with you today.
So Alana, today we are chatting about artificial intelligence when it comes to national security. There's obviously a lot of applications for artificial intelligence, but national security is one of the really big and important ways in which artificial intelligence can impact our day-to-day lives. So can you just give us the big picture when it comes to the use of AI for national security? When did it start and where are we at right now?
Thank you. You know, it's interesting because we're about a week post the president's AI executive order. Last week, there was also a summit in the UK, lots and lots happening. But believe it or not, artificial intelligence was first coined in the 50s. And about 6 years ago, DOD started to really dive into some of the policy around this. But I think what really hit it big was a year ago when we learned about ChatGPT, and then we started hearing about homework assignments being written by AI, and certainly before that, hearing about deep fakes. So all of this is artificial intelligence. And what AI really is, it's the intersection of super high computing with a lot of data sets that allow computers to begin to learn from their own machinations and to almost mimic human thinking. And that's really the AI difference, because computers can learn from their own experiences, process data, and suggest decisions. That's why AI is so critical to self-driving cars and robotics. But as I said before, also those deep fakes that we've been seeing on pop-up ads and some of the media sources, and even its most recent reputation for writing college essays. AI has all sorts of uses. But when we say national security, people really think killer robots. And obviously, it's not all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that as a journalist, I've been tracking in terms of the deep fakes and all of these different challenges that that AI brings to the journalism industry. You just mentioned one of the ways in which it probably would impact the national security space with these kind of robot soldiers. And I think the benefits of AI-enabled soldiers might seem very obvious, right? You are reducing soldier casualties. But what are some of the other maybe benefits or drawbacks of this AI tech being used for national security purposes?
Sure. It's almost a mirror image, the pros and the cons. And so just to mention some of the pros, obviously you can make our weapons smarter. You can use AI to sift through loads of information and create targets, look for systems. That's why AI has been very important as a partner to satellite imagery to better understand what our soldiers might be going into or even how to target. But there's so much more. AI can speed up all kinds of administrative processes. I've heard of a firm that is using AI to sift through systems of clearances and classifications to have a smarter all of government approach. AI can be used in speeding up biological research and developing new types of pharmaceuticals, new types of cures. By the same token, the scary part of AI, of course, is what people think of as a loss of control. You know, because you can have so much faster decision making, do you have enough of a human element in deciding on weapons targets? Can you actually create a bioweapon, because you're now creating that kind of possibility of creating new cures, but also new pharmaceuticals that could be bioweapons. And ultimately, artificial intelligence is a computer-based system, and it is vulnerable to computer hacks. So that certainly makes it a concern. I'd like to also mention one other thing, because I think when people think about AI adversaries, they think really robust technological countries like China. But if you think about it, for example, in the last several conflicts, we have seen a lot of DIY weapons created that really harm the U.S. military. Drones, which has been a terrific step for the U.S. military, have also become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and there are commercial drones. AI is going in the same direction. There's a lot of open source AI, and so smaller adversaries, which need to use asymmetric force, can also use especially open source artificial intelligence to enable their smaller weapon systems to become smarter and more difficult for us to address.
I hadn't necessarily realized that it's not just governments, maybe adversarial governments, who are investing and doing a lot of research and work in this space. But as you mentioned, it's maybe more rogue elements within certain countries that are also exploring and exploiting these new technologies. Tell us about who has the advantage, why, and how are we supposed to keep up with these kind of ever-changing and evolving situations when you have so many different ways to use AI in so many different applications?
Sure. It's a great question. I'm still very bullish on the United States having the edge for a number of reasons. Some of the best AI companies, all the fresh developments in artificial intelligence are coming out of the United States. Moreover, the layer that AI depends on, the supercomputing, the chips, and particularly the more sophisticated chips, are still being developed in the US, and we continue to have the best education systems. We continue to have the best sort of entrepreneurial grounding for this kind of innovation. So at this stage, I'm very, very bullish on this. Moreover, our government is taking a very serious approach to this. As I said, DoD has been thinking about this for some time. At the beginning of this year, DoD updated its directive on autonomous weapons and ethical standards. Deputy Secretary Hicks had launched something known as Task Force Lima, which is an all of DoD, and indeed it's trying to have an all of government approach to how to really think about enterprise AI, how to foster the best, and also think about vulnerabilities. And the president's executive order has issued a set of directives to all of government. And that's really important. Now, the chips, which is one of the main ingredients in AI, is so important. And of course, we did allow that industry to offshore for a while. President Biden's trying to bring that back, along with a number of state governors, in developing the CHIPS Act and all of the funding that goes along with it. So that's really important and is also good for us. But I think it also is a lesson that with a more nascent industry, we need to think about the right economic and regulatory environment so that it continues to develop here in the US rather than offshoring. And, you know, one other thing in terms of specific government investments, there are such things as the microelectronics commons that have these small hubs that help to develop a technology over to for it to be fabricated. There are these manufacturing institutes, which are public-private partnerships that do the same. There are ones devoted to both microelectronics and AI. And that is a good thing, because some of this is just about how is science developed. And as long as we continue to keep this industry here, we're going to continue to innovate, because that's how you innovate, right? It's that classic tinkering of engineers and you innovate. Now, China is very, very serious about looking at AI as well. It had a 2017, I think it was, strategy, and that's certainly just the tip of the iceberg, because there's so much kind of hidden behind China's secrecy walls. There are a lot of concerns about data coming to China through commercial industry like TikTok. And that's another ingredient. There are a lot of chips fabs there. So all of that is certainly concerning. And so we do need to have an approach of both fostering this industry, but also putting the right kind of guardrails on not allowing an adversary to use it in a way that could create a problem in this kind of AI race.
You know, and I'd love to dig into that a little bit, because that's one of the challenges you often hear from folks saying, well, if we start setting up guardrails around AI, that's going to give our adversaries an advantage, right? If they don't have those same type of guardrails. I wonder what your take is on that. What's the right balance to strike in terms of making sure that we are fostering these industries, making sure we're not falling behind, but at the same time, we're also not, the technology isn't getting away from us in the way that you mentioned previously.
Sure. It's always a great question. AI is a big, big term that means a lot of different things. And there's a lot of open architecture out there that's already out there, right? And you're never going to put technology back in the box. So I think that the right balance is thinking about where is the critical edge, and that keeps moving, and keeping that very critical edge domestically while it's still so new, but allowing other types of the lesser capabilities to be fully open and internationalized. And in fact, it's sort of good for our national security. National security isn't just a matter of how many weapons we have. It's diplomacy, it's foreign aid, it's cultural and business diplomacy. There's a whole State Department office around commercial diplomacy. And so to the extent that, if we're picking on China, an adversary like China has been using its Belt and Road Initiative to go into a lot of other countries' poorer economies, that's an opportunity for us as well, with the forms of knowledge that we're comfortable having shared out there. So I think that the balance is fine. And I think that the area of AI that is most worrisome, you know, to the extent, for example, it's a national security or a biological issue, could be kept in those contained. In fact, that's kind of how the EO is trying to set this up, the executive order, excuse me. It's not even saying don't do anything. It's saying for the most powerful types of computing, we want to know how you're testing, your test results, called red teams. We want to know more information. And interestingly, the European Union has passed an AI law, which now is going to go through their process. So it's not going to go into force, I believe, for another year and a half at least. But they have also taken an approach of the most risky to the least risky. And interestingly, their most risky isn't even so much around what we're talking about, like national security. It's around personal data and civil rights.
Okay, so let's talk then, what happens when or if we fall behind when it comes to that AI race, right? I'm thinking protecting secrets, cryptology. What are the implications of us not keeping up and not fostering this industry in the way we need to?
Yeah, I think in some ways my answer is we just can't let that happen. We need to continue to innovate here, and also to think about how that innovation ought to be implemented across government. In some ways, I think that the two challenges for us really is, one, when government needs new technologies, some of course are internally developed, but so much is developed in the commercial sector, and particularly with smaller companies that are not already on contract with government, particularly the defense complex, it's very hard to get into those contractual terms. And so I'd say one thing that the government should be thinking about, and I do believe from what I could see, Deputy Secretary's thinking about this, is how to ensure that there are these openings for innovative companies to get in front of government to showcase what they can do. Another major difficulty, which is going to be true for any large, complex, distributed organization, is how to make sure that what one part of the government is doing can be used for other parts of the government. They're not reinventing the wheel, and worse, not doing things in opposition to each other. Again, that's something that Task Force Lima is trying to do. That's something DOD has tried to do for many years. It's always incredibly difficult, but I think the more people try, the more they can get their arms around it. And in the end, we have all kinds of very scary weapon systems like nuclear weapons. And what has been helpful over time is that you get an international consensus with some rules of the road. You can always talk about, truthfully, about Russia leaving some of those treaties and concerns about hidden weapons and hidden research, as in Iran. But nevertheless, you do have some agreed upon rules of the road. And I think that that's something people are talking about with like-minded countries. That's something that happened in the UK last week when the vice president was there. So that diplomatic approach is also really important. And one other thing that people don't think about often when it comes to national security, they don't think about the people and immigration. And that's another piece. AI, really any technology, is ultimately really based on human talent. And so we need to be able to get more people into government that are good at this, support diversity in the people who can get into college and follow this path. And a little more controversial, but really think about when foreign students come to the U.S. and they're really talented and they want to stay, and there's a commercial entity that wants to hire them. You know, we're losing a lot of talent because we don't have the right visas for them. So I think that that's something else. And that's something that was in the executive order.
Yeah, these are all really interesting ways to think about AI in the national security space. As also, when you mentioned immigration, it also reminded me of some of the work and stories that I've been doing in terms of face recognition and some of the work that's being done through the CBP One app and other types of technologies to better identify the people that are coming in and out trying to enter our country. So all really important implications and applications.
Yeah. And if I could say something about that, by the way, because it feeds into it's how our government is working on the border, but it's the same issue when people talk about how is AI being used for hiring decisions or deep fakes and what that means for hate crimes or hate speech and all of that. Again, fundamentally, it's the two pieces here is how good is the data? Is the data that's teaching the computer itself already compromised in terms of racism or what have you, so that what it spits out is more of the same? And how good are the ethical frameworks? And we're just in the nascent stage of working on those ethical frameworks, but I'm confident that there's more than one answer. We just have to be willing to do it.
Alana, blow my mind here. What is kind of the latest and greatest and kind of more like the thing that you're most excited about when it comes to the way that we can use artificial intelligence in when it comes to national security? I'd love to hear some kind of nuggets.
Sure. I think it's being used right now. You know, I'm excited to say this summer there were a lot of hearings on something called the Replicator Initiative, which is really thinking about how to use a bunch of drones together to make a smarter weapon. Well, to do that, AI is the way to really do some of that and put that into effect. I think that in the biospace, it's super, super interesting. Having gone through COVID, we have seen how quickly we need to come up with a solution, but we've also seen, you know, what people have been warning about potential for how this harms the country. We can move much faster. AI just moves quicker than a human brain at times. And so we can move much faster in development. And so that could be exciting. But we're also just, you know, in other places, the Earth is now surrounded by satellites. There's so much data coming at us. Can we actually use it all? Well, what if you used AI to, together with satellite images, for example, to hone in really fast in case of a disaster to really target who you need to rescue?
You were the national security advisor for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She's a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Intelligence Committee. If you were testifying before one of those committees today, what would you want them to know and do about this topic?
Thank you. I think that, of course, I'd want to testify to my audience. So I already know that Senator Gillibrand has been very, very interested in this personnel issue. She passed the bill around cybersecurity and getting scholarships and recruiting opportunities to more students and more diverse body of students. Super important for AI. In fact, that program could be used for AI, but that's really important. How do you really get people into the department, into the intelligence community? How do you get more diverse bodies of students in? And then how do you use different kinds of hiring authorities to be able to compete with the technology space where companies can pay much more, they can move much faster. So that's the personnel space. That's super, super important. Investment in addressing the valley of death, as they call it, from ideas and the labs to actual implementation. We're already doing some of that. I have seen that China has spent something like $38 billion. I may be a little bit off. We've got to match that. You know, we need to be investing because some of this is just the yeast to creating, to allowing companies to really create something. You asked about controls earlier. We know how to control physical assets. We know how to say you can't sell a weapon to another country, to a third country, without all of our reviews. And we need to be able to then go and inspect that it's being used in the right way. We don't yet know how to do that. How to create guardrails around licenses and foreign use. Again, the executive order has a nod at this. I'm not sure how workable it is, to be honest, because it's about cloud companies reporting on foreign uses. I think that there's lots of different ways to spoof that. So I would have a commission really studying exports and sanctions, export controls and sanctions around this issue. I'm not saying we absolutely should shut the lid. It's impossible. We can't do it. But we should be really thoughtful about protocols we can use to create appropriate guardrails around a small subset of really cutting edge, powerful AI tools.
And then you said, word that I think for folks in the industry, they understand, but could you explain for our general audience the valley of death and what that means when it comes to AI and technology?
Sure. Yeah, it's often applied really to physical manufacturing, but the idea is you have something that develops, you know, it's an idea, then maybe you develop it as a very, very small pilot, but to get from that to actually full manufacturing capability, that's where they call the valley of death, because it's this, you know, how do you deal with the logistics of doing something big? Where do you get the funding? Do you have the customers before you can create the product? Can you afford to do that? Lots and lots of questions. And that's what these manufacturing institutes were intended to do. Now, you might say AI, you know, it's an algorithm that you write, but the truth is it really requires a ton of data. It requires very sophisticated computing and large amounts of energy. All of that is very expensive. And you want to continue to foster innovation, right? We don't want to have just a few large players. So that's the valley of death I'm talking about. And that probably requires some public support for those kinds of activities and really supporting entrepreneurs.
Do you think we have the kind of support in Congress and across our intelligence agencies and from the public to really do what it takes to get where we need to go?
You know, I think that the people in Congress really follow this. I think generally support, especially when you can show them the return on investments in other technologies. But right now, of course, Congress is really mired in its own battles. It's not going to happen this year, may not happen next year, but I think it's really important. So I think that the request, if it's going to come, is going to come from the administration, because I do think that sitting in what the Pentagon, the intelligence community, the Commerce Department, which has the responsibility for a lot of this, most of the AI executive order first rests with the Commerce Department and the other agencies. There are a lot of smart people who get it, and they would need the congressional support. This is not the kind of thing the public usually latches onto. You know, I think that they like the end product, but until you get to the end product, it's very difficult to explain.
Ilana, any last thoughts before we let you go?
I think this is a great moment, and the U.S. really is in the driver's seat, but it continues to take all kinds of investment. I don't mean just money, to continue to be in the driver's seat. And that's what I hope our country is really up for. I believe it is, but it's going to take people continuing to support the notion, and also ethical development, so that some big embarrassing or scary problem doesn't scare the public in a way that will be detrimental to this development.
That's really great insight. Ilana Breutman with the Roosevelt Group, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can find hundreds of other exceptional experts by visiting roleyapp.com. I'm Catalina Villegas, and you can always connect with me on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Until next time.